Gene Shepard.
You see, the trouble with Aunt Teresa was not a troubled doll. It was just a common human face. Aunt? Listen, I want you to very, very carefully follow every word that I am about to utter. And this is serious. This is probably one of the most serious things that's ever happened to this country. And I believe that I am the first man in the eastern section of this United States to have discovered it. It's a terrible plot, an awful thing that's beginning to happen. Now, let me tell you exactly what happened. I come down to the station this morning. Now, the station is a standard, ordinary sort of building. I mean, it's an office building, you know? There are all kinds of accountants, second-rate dentists, guys who do tax returns. There are Christmas tree salesmen, all sorts of ordinary businessmen up and down throughout this entire gigantic honeycomb of a building. It's right here on Broadway, right in the middle of Manhattan, right in the middle of these United States. Stable country. Country that believes in right things. Has God on its side. I mean, right? Okay, correct. We know exactly where we are. So I came down here this morning. I am an employee here. I'm a hard-working man. I do exactly what I am paid to do. I am here. I do it. I go through my song and dance. I tap dance. I do my routine. I play my nose flute. I pick up my pittance and I go. I don't bother anybody, right? I have not rubbed anyone's fur the wrong way, correct? Okay, all right. Now, we know where we stand. I come down to this place this morning. And I arrive in front of my office, this little hole in the wall that they have assigned to two or three of us. And I reach in my pocket and take out the key. I have a key, a regular Yale lock key. You know, the official kind of key that opens apartments on the east side and that. And I go up to this door and I try to put the key in. Nothing happens. I turn it over and I try it again. Nothing happens. So then I take out my other gigantic pile of keys that are all attached to this long chain that keep falling out of my pocket and breaking at the horn and hard art and all that. So I, one by one, I try each one, knowing full well that none of these are the keys to this door. But a man can't believe such a thing can happen. This is Saturday morning. The sun is shining. There are tourists walking up and down as though nothing is happening right there on Times Square. See, now listen carefully. This has to do with you, not me, you, all of us. And so I'm beginning to work around with this lock, and I suddenly, it dawns on me, I can't get in the office. I'm locked out. I call the air conditioning, the guys who maintain the, none of them can get in. The doors are all locked, and none of their keys work. This is on Saturday morning in this country, America. I can't get in the office. Everything, all the things I own, all the important things are locked in that office now. My nose flute, my commercials, what else is there in my life? So I come up to the studio here, and all these people here are totally unconcerned, not knowing what is occurring. Now, I'd like to point out just exactly what this means. I have a suspicion that this has happened. It's an awful thought. But do you realize this town is vulnerable? We are wide open on Saturday mornings. All you poor clowns are sitting out in Darien. You poor idiots are sitting on your duffs out there in New Rochelle, not knowing nothing about what's going on in your office on a Saturday morning. And I'm inquiring around here, and I asked the elevator operator, I said, was there anybody up here? He says, why, yes, a short, stout man wearing a dark overcoat with a velvet collar appeared, carrying a thin briefcase and a large ring of keys. He left, he said, within 10 minutes. It could very well be possible that this man, this short, stout man, is only one of a large phalanx of short, stout men bearing briefcases who have appeared all over Manhattan. Do you realize what this could do to this country if Monday morning 2.5 million men descend upon Manhattan with the wrong keys? What is the first assumption you make when your key doesn't work in the lock? Of course, you know what the first thing that you think of in this town. You arrive at your office, you try the key, you immediately get in the elevator, go down, and head for the unemployment office. That's all there is to do. Either that or you go right back home on the 1037 and you arrive back in Darien. You go home and you say, I left my keys. Where are my keys? I could see this beautiful scene of the guy arriving home. He says, hey, Mabel, I left my keys, for crying out loud. It's about 11 o'clock now. And his wife says, what do you mean you left your keys? You don't have, there are no keys here. I must have taken the wrong keys, Mabel. Come on now, give me them keys. Hurry up, I left them on the buffet, for crying out loud. Hurry up. And she goes in and rustles through the buffet. She says, there's a couple of keys to the garage here. She says, well, no, come on, the keys. Give me the keys, quick. These keys don't work. These are the only keys you've had, Charles. And then the panic begins to hit Charlie. He sits down and says, why didn't they have the guts to tell me? Why didn't they tell me? Why didn't they tell you? Look, I have a suspicion. What with the abstract life that we're all involved in, the paper life, the life of deep, abject fear that most of us live in, and it's a fear, it's not a fear really of bombs. It's not a fear of the decline of Western civilization. Let me tell you, in spite of what the writers write about, it is not a fear of the great threat of rising imperialism in the East. None of these things bother the average guy. Oh, no. It's the terrible sneaking suspicion that one day they're going to discover what a phonus balonus he really is, and not even with so much as to dignify it with a pink slip, blue slip, or green slip, they merely just changed the lock. That's all there is to it, and he'll know exactly why they did it. And I fully believe that this country could be invaded, could be disrupted, completely destroyed. For 3 whole days, no one would even find it out, because no one would have the guts to say anything to the next guy. They locked me out of the office. The only thing that would happen would be by Wednesday, there would be 17.5 million guys lined up in front of the unemployment office on 42nd Street, all of them pretending that, you know, I mean, carrying on with the big front, until somebody by about 3 o'clock in the afternoon would discover that the unemployment guys have been locked out and they are in the line too. And by then, of course, someone would appear on the radio and say, it's all over. It is all over. We have the keys now. And to the right thinkers in the audience, to the right thinkers in this big country of ours, this wonderful country which is now ours, to the right thinkers will go the right keys. Apply. Signed, the commissar. So I believe that George Orwell was wrong. Seriously, it's not going to be the way Orwell said it was. It's not going to even be the way Huxley said it was. Oh, this could be happening right now. You better call your office this very minute. You had better call your office this very minute, because I am locked out. I have no commercials. I have nothing, nothing. I stand before you, a man not only shorn of his commercials and his nose flute, but shorn of his dignity too. And all I can say is to my fellow Americans, for crying out loud, why didn't we think of this? Well, I guess in a way we had it coming to us. I mean, in a sense, we did. We abdicated all along the line, each one of us. I mean, I'll admit, I never realized the value. Yeah, I can just see. Do you realize that I'm locked out of the men's room? Huh. I mean, you know what this can result in. I don't have to go any further with that. Thousands and thousands and thousands of people just wait and see Monday. Don't be out there laughing. Don't laugh at all. Because the time is going to come, say about 3 o'clock Monday afternoon, you're going to remember where you heard it first. Not on Winchell's program or on Barry Gray. Edward R. Murrow didn't even note that it was happening. So concerned was he over the Middle Eastern crisis. Right here in our very midst. Well, I think we had it coming. I mean, I'm walking. I mean, the signs are there. The signs are there, really. They have been all around us for centuries. This morning, I'm walking along, and I'm on 7th Avenue, and I'm about maybe at 52nd, 53rd Street, something like that, on 7th Avenue. And there is a typical American family group milling around. They have come in from Millfield, New Jersey, or Milling Pond, Connecticut. And they have arrived, and they are sort of standing on the corner there, and there's a short, stout father type. A real father. This guy was born with a salt and pepper mustache. His mother had a difficult time. He was born with a salt and pepper mustache. He's standing there, and he's kind of milling. He's pear-shaped, and his wife is a sort of pear-shaped wife. And they're milling, and they had this look on the face of, well, where shall we go now? What are we going to do? We are in the big city now. This is what we've come for. Now where to? Will it be the Roxy to see the Rockettes? Shall we go down to Rockefeller Center and just watch the flags flop? Or shall we, you know this thing. Well, here we are, now what? And they're standing around, and mother's looking west, and he's looking east, and there are two gawky, gangling kids of the modern progressive school type kids. You know, you can always tell the way the girl brushes her hair and the kind of blazer that the kid wears. They're much better dressed than the parents. All the dough has been invested in these two striplings. And the two of them were standing there. and I heard this. I'm going to tell you exactly what I heard. Father has said, obviously, what he wants to do. Mother has countermanded what he wants to do. She has something else. They're both standing there. And this tall, brushed girl, who already, at the age of 13, has a little set of letters above her head that say, betrothed. You know, you can just see her looking right out of the Harold Tribb Society page. And she says to mother and father with a commanding voice, that's the sad part of it, she says, let's have a discussion. Let's have a discussion. This is a democratic discussion, you see. This is the ideal of all the Spocks, all the parent magazines, 17, Zip, Pip, Quick, all the rest of them, that whenever things are going wrong, have a discussion. Rely on the judgment of these idiotic 13-year-olders. And in the end, give in to them, you see, through a long series of illogical arguments. And so I'm walking there, and this chick, this 13-year-older, says, let's have a discussion. And poor father, I could see he just sort of wilted a little bit, and mother wilted a little bit, and I knew what the discussion was going to result in. And it's no wonder we've lost our keys. It is no wonder we have lost. We have lost the combination to the lock. and I go, you know, about 10 minutes before that, I'm walking past Carnegie Hall. And here is a real Schraft lady standing out. This is, by the way, the gathering place for Schraft ladies on Saturday afternoons and Saturday nights. And they're all standing out there. And there's one wearing, you know, the kind of fur wrap, the little fur wrap that looks like a kind of a brownish fur wrap that kind of goes halfway around the shoulders and hangs down to about the shoulder blades. You know, this little kind of, what do they call those things? These are old lady type. Is that a stole? Well, she's got this thing around her, and she's wearing this little pot turned upside down on her head. You know, a real Schrafty hat. And she's standing there, and this is exactly what happened. I'm going to outline to you why we have lost our keys. We have lost the combination. And I'm walking past her, paying absolutely no attention to this old gal, and she's paying no attention to me, and all of a sudden she's, for heaven's sakes, for pity's sakes. And I turned, you know, I thought she was saying something to me. And she tore out on the sidewalk and kind of went into an Immelman turn, you know, a slow looping turn, made a turn to the right, and there another one who looked exactly like her came darting out of a doorway, and they both clasped each other. She says, Emily, for pity's sakes, I've been waiting for a dog's age. Where have you been? And Emily says, right here in the doorway, Clara. And they were both clinging to each other, and I thought, oh, what a touching scene. And all of a sudden, Emily says, Clara, for crying out loud, let's grab a hot dog and get in line. And the two of them went into Needick's right there next to Carnegie. Let's grab a hot dog. It's no wonder we've lost our keys. Speaking of the lost, this is WOR AM and FM New York. Friendly, reliable, sober, industrious, and vaguely confused.
Now let's beat out a message via Tom Tom.
That move there. That was pretty good, wasn't it? All right, George, we ought to be locked out all our lives. Actually, I think, it's a funny thing. I'd like to make a point here. Now, don't be too frightened. It is quite possible you are locked out. Now, you have all of Saturday afternoon, you have all of Sunday morning and Sunday evening to contemplate it. Now, there's another side to this thing. It isn't as bad as it seems. In fact, it is much better than it seems. I have a suspicion that the best thing that could happen to 90% of the males in this country would be to be locked out. I mean, I'm serious about that. I mean, I know a whole lot of guys who, if they were relieved of the responsibility of telling the boss what to do with his key, if they were relieved of the responsibility of quitting, they would sneak back home on the 5:32 with this fantastic sense of relief. And of course, they would be weeping and pretending that it was a terrible thing. They would arrive home and they would go through all the motions. And then by Tuesday morning, they would awake and they'd notice that sun shining out there, and they'd hear a few of the birds whistling. And they would not even, it's a surprising thing how many of us go through our lives bound and shackled and held down by enormous chains, which we think, of course, are terribly important and necessary to our existence. Which, as in the matter of fact, are really the one agent that is preventing us from existing, from being really true and real, from being what we want to be. I'd just like to know how many guys are sitting out there listening to this now. And their wives, of course, think this is a ridiculous thing. What do you mean, Charles? Why, it would be terrible if Charles was locked out of the agency. I just wonder how many guys have this sneaking thing deep inside of them who are saying, oh boy, oh, would that be great? Oh, come on, admit it, you know? It would be great. Because a lot of things would happen. First of all, I think one of the things that has begun to worry many people in this country is the constantly advancing effeminization of the male. It's really not as simple as that. That the advancing masculization of the female has, in so creating a new atmosphere, has in a sense removed some of the masculinity from the male. In short, a male is only masculine when compared to a female and her degree of femininity. It's not that the women have lost femaleness, they have lost femininity. It's not that the males have lost maleness, they have lost masculinity. And so, as you look around, you see all the stage shows, almost all of the movies today, feature the new stars who have come up since about 1949 or 50 are all vaguely feminine. That is to say, they're not outwardly completely masculine, say in the Spencer Tracy mold of a previous era, you see, total masculine, you know, or in the mold of, say, the Clark Gables, or a mold of the Victor McLaughlins of the past. I mean, this was a complete masculine man. And so gradually there has been a change, a slight coloring of it all. And I could just see this little man whose sole function in life has been to supply an endless stream of dollars for the, quote, activities of the family. The station wagons that are coming and going, and the kids that are going to this school and that school, the wife who's going to this club and that club, and the whole bit. His sole function has been to supply this endless stream. Funny thing the elevator operator said today. I'm coming in. And he said it right out of the blue. Funny, you know, Saturday mornings, I think, are very valuable times for consulting your navel. Really. Because, honestly, a lot of the hoopla and a lot of the paper bag popping and a lot of the paper doll cutting out has ceased, you know, in these places. And you begin to see things for what they are. The file cabinets look gray and deserted and a little menacing and very faceless. They look okay, you know, when there's a lot of girls standing in front of them moving the drawers up and down. But, boy, they look something else again when you see them with nobody. They just sit there waiting. And they contain all of our lives, all of ours, right there, packed away in alphabetical order, cross-indexed. And so I come in here, you know, and I'm very quietly standing on the elevator with my cup of lukewarm coffee, and the elevator operator suddenly turns to me and says, "I don't know what it's about." I said, "What? Huh? What?" He says, "I don't know. I figure some of these guys are going to come in here on Judgment Day." I said, "What?" What? Now I'm beginning to wait. Judgment Day. I hear the great bugles blowing and the gong, and I wonder how suddenly Judgment Day. And I'm waking out of my lethargy. I said, "Judgment Day? What do you mean Judgment Day?" He says, "Well, I'll tell you." He says, "You know, there are some guys. I've been riding this elevator now for 20 years. There are some guys who come into this office 7 days a week into this building. They come in at 7 o'clock in the morning. They don't leave until 10 o'clock at night." And they do this 7 days. They've been doing it now for 20 years. I don't know how long they were doing it before I came here and how long they're going to do it after I leave. They're going to come in on Judgment Day. Wonder what these guys get out of life. And I had no answer. Absolutely no answer. And then I began to think, you know, I get off the elevator and I walk back with my key held hopefully in my hand. And I try it in the door and I'm locked out. And I'm struggling around. There's the first moment of panic, and then there's the great moment of relief. And I turn around. I'm walking away from the door. Okay. And it suddenly occurred to me that these guys, that most of these guys who spend their lives going up and down elevators and shuffling papers back and forth are running as hard as they can, just as wildly and as hard as they can from something else. They're not running to something. They're running away from something. And they're running away from this involvement with mankind and with the human being, with the family, with the people. Because you're not involved with people at all when you're involved with file cabinets and papers and deals. That's totally abstract. And I'm going up the stairway then. I try the men's room. I'm locked out. I'm wandering around there, and I'm disenfranchised. And I say, "Well, you know, maybe the bugles are getting ready to blow. Who knows?" And I suspect in some ways that they might be. Like today, I'm walking. These are all things that happened to me today. Exactly. All in one line. Just lined right up. I'm walking along. I passed one block after I heard Emily talking to Clara. And I'm in the next block, and I'm waiting for a light. And a cab pulls up. And I'm suddenly reminded of an incident that occurred to me 4 or 5, maybe 3 or 6 or 9 days ago. Are you a collector of cab companies' names? You know, don't fall into the idea that all cabs are just cabs. And don't begin to believe that they're all named either Yellow or Checker. They are not. That there are thousands of cabs in this right here in this city that have a little red series of block letters on the back doors that tell the name of the cab company. Now, how this works is that if you're a cab company owner and say you own 100 cabs, well, for tax purposes, what these guys do is split their company up into about 30 different little companies, and each company owns 3 cabs, you see. It's kind of a corporation tax deal, and actually it's one big company, but there are 30 little corporations, and each one has to have a name that has to be put on the outside of the cab. And so they come up with some great names. I'm telling you, some of the greatest names. For example, there is the Money Cab Company. I mean, how's that for a guy getting right down to the basic of it all? I saw this when I by George, there's the Money Cab Company. And one day I get in the cab and it says Friendly Cab Company. And I get in, and there's this little gnarled cab driver sitting up there in the front seat, and he's and you know, this kind of guy who has a constant stream, an untapped stream of obscenity, just running right through him like a fountain, and it bubbles out of his ears and out of his eyes and out of his. Yeah, and there's hate, little lines of hate extending from him, and it's as though he has thorns growing out all over him, and there are little filaments reaching out that have poisonous tentacles on the. And I arrive at the end of my trip. I hand the guy his tip. Here I've gone. You know, it's getting to the point now. You know all those little cab driver tricks. For example, giving you your change in all dimes. The reason this is done, of course, so that you can't give 15-cent tips. So if you get a 40-cent cab ride, he'll give you your change in all dimes. You can't give him a dime tip. You wind up giving him a 50% tip, you know, 20 cents for a block. And so he tries this routine, and I reach in my pocket, and I got a nickel. So here we've gone this little way. We've gone about four blocks or something like that, and I give him 15 cents, which is a standard tip for this little... He looks at me like that, and he slams the door, and there goes the friendly cab company off in the distance. Then there was another great moment that happened to me. I get in a cab on Madison Avenue the other day, and it's one of those terrible moments when we turn left, we get into a crosstown street, and every truck, every bicycle, every motor scooter, 14,000 cabs, 95 policemen, 7 fire trucks, everything has converged on us. We are completely trapped. And I am sitting there, and all I can hear is the sound of muffled curses around me and the tick of the meter. My lifeblood is dripping out of me on the floor. Like that, you see. I'm sitting there for about 40 minutes, it seemed, and the smoke is rising and the steam, and it's hot. You know, it's really hot already there, you know. It's hot. You can see the city. It might as well be in mid-August, steaming. And finally, it's off for crying out loud. And I get out of the cab, and by now I've run up a bill of a buck. So I give the guy $1.25, and I slam the door, and I look at the... And there it is, the name on the door, and I'm telling you, this happened to me. Listen to this. The Hopeless Cab Company. I paid this guy $1.25, and I go off down the street amid all the guys pushing the little carts and fist fighting and standing around by the fire plugs, and I'm wending my way through, and I says, by George Shepherd, you have just seen the truth. You have just suddenly, right there in the middle of Babylon on the Hudson, it has hit you. The Hopeless Cab Company. And some other poor clown, as soon as I got out of the cab, you know, he flipped the flag up and down and the light went on, and some other poor idiot got in and sat. Oh, I had the feeling of the River Styx and Sharon and the whole crowd. And this cab driver was one of those jowled type. You know, the dark, silent type of cab driver that just sits there. Doesn't say anything. He's got one arm hanging out the door and he just sits. And on the back of his back seat was a little sign that said, keep smiling. In blue letters. Keep smiling in the Hopeless Cab Company's cab. Just sitting there. Just sitting there waiting for it to happen. It's like, of course, you see, I have the sensation that we are really all of us secretly, and I don't like to pound a nail, you know, down. I pound a nail too deeply under the surface because it's there. You don't have to say it sometimes. There are many things that do not have to be said and shouldn't be said. And one of them is, well, I'm going to say, Beckett said it, Samuel Beckett, Jonathan Swift said it, a lot of people have said it, Plato said it in one way, Aristotle said it, certainly Euripides said it. And it's this, that underneath all those layers, all those onion skin layers of existence, there lies that one little thing somewhere deep down inside of man that is waiting for something. And he doesn't quite know what it is. He is waiting. And so he's sitting there on his duff all throughout all eternity, just waiting, always waiting. And the other day, I had a wonderful test of this the other day. I'm sitting there at my scrungy old desk, and suddenly the phone rings. Well, it's taken me years to learn to avoid ringing phones. No, really, it has. Seriously, one of the hardest tests of a man's courage is to let a phone ring and not answer it. Because all of us expect on the other end is going to be the answer. We pick it up, you know, that hopeful feeling of picking up. And there's that same old clown. Your old cast of characters, they're still making their appearances. Wouldn't you like to get a call from somebody great one time? I mean, don't you ever get sick of the cast of characters that you're playing in your play with? Really? Can you imagine the program of your play? The play that you're part of, cast of characters, leading characters, features, bit part players, heavies, villains, good guys, bad guys. What a scrunchy, nothing crowd. I mean, not one distinguished name in the lot. Not one man who rises above real mediocrity. I mean, wouldn't you like to have a cast of characters that include Daryl Zanuck, President Truman, Abe Stark, all the way on down the line. These are the people that are playing parts out in here. But I pick up the phone, it's the same old guys. You know, hello, yeah. And there's nothing on the end of the line. There's nothing this time. Guys just sitting out there breathing. You can hear him breathing on the phone. I say, hello, what do you want? He says, and it's a friend of mine. I recognize the voice, but he's got a crack in his voice now. He says, did it come yet? I says, what? He says, I guess it didn't. I says, no, and hung up. And I recognized for an instant that there was a moment of recognition there between he and I, him and me, us and them. We and you. We're all waiting for it to come. And about 10 minutes later, I dialed him back and I said, what? Did what come? He says, nothing. Doesn't matter anymore. And I've never mentioned it to him again. But it's all part and parcel of the same problem. It's the same thing. I mean, it's the waiting, just sitting around waiting. It's summer now, you see. You have been waiting for summer, right? I mean, everybody's been vaguely waiting for summer. If you haven't, then your glands are giving you trouble, and I would suggest you do something. One of the suggestions of Carlton Fredericks might do it. You are having trouble with juice. I would suggest, you know, I mean, a little deep knee bends and a few of this. But most of us have been thinking about this, waiting for summer to come. All right, it's here. Now what? So now you're going to go out to Jones Beach. Sit on your duff for a while out there. And this will go on for a while. And then vaguely you'll begin to wait for fall. And this waiting and this expectancy that the next season is always going to transcend all the other seasons you have known can be seen in the shop windows. That already by June they will be showing fall clothes. And everyone will be feeling vaguely happy about it. Oh, boy, it's going to be great. It's going to be wonderful. I'm wearing a new sweater and all this. And by the time November arrives, spring clothing will already be in the windows. Do you remember? Just before Christmas, they were showing them already. And I'd say by the end of May, there will be summer clearances already, getting rid of it all. And it's getting to be more and more advanced, you see. More and more. I remember one time there was an automobile company. See, the point that I'm making here is that most of us live either in the past or in the future. That if we live in the future, we're always saying, oh, it's going to be all right. Or if we live in the past, we say, oh, I mean, you guys, oh, the good old, oh, let me tell you about the good old days. Hardly anybody swings for the now. This is the rarest kind of individual. Perhaps he doesn't even exist at all because of what man is, you see. The conscience on one hand, the imagination on the other. You see, the imagination takes you out of your current situation and shoots you forward to this cleaner, better, brighter, unsullied time. And the conscience takes you back to a simpler time, hence a time of less sin in your own life or whatever it is that you live. I will not call it a life. And so we go along there, and I remember about 3 or 4 years ago, there was a car company. Who remembers this? There was a car company that had a great big sign that said, suddenly it's 1960. Do you remember that? Well, here it is. Of course, the implication being that since 1960 seems so far in the future, that 1960 was going to be a year when all the problems were solved and we have finally reached that ultimate stage of development and whatever it is, progression, that there will be no more difficult. That if you could get something that is going to be developed in 1970, now many of your problems will be solved. That these things will go beyond. It's kind of an illusion that man is constantly improving himself by the machines and the things around him. It's a very, very comforting illusion, too, I might point out. And yet, as each successive model comes and goes, last year's model is infinitely inferior to this year's model. You notice that? Last year's model just doesn't make it, in spite of the facts that this year's model is now in the garage having work done on its transmission. You see, it constantly, eternally, it goes this way. The feeling and the desire that change should be always, and is always, by the very nature of change, good. It is good. And so, suddenly it's 1960. Do any of you remember that ad? I will award the brass figlegee with bronze oak leaf palm if you can just tell me the name of the company that did that. Suddenly it's 1960. Well, suddenly it is 1960. You feel cleaner, brighter? Do you have the new thin line look? Do you? Are you a sociable now? I mean, has it happened in the last 3 years? Have things really begun to square away now? Really, really begun to have that new clean look? I mean, in your life, you see, as opposed to the new clean look of the buildings that are rising around us. Or the cars that are sprouting up everywhere. The new clean look in your life. Smooth, sanded down, and made of green glass. Totally transparent, and above all, antiseptic. No. Never to be sullied by those dirty footprints of short, squat little boys who are wearing worn tennis shoes, slopping through the mud of existence. Clop, 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 clop. I just wonder how many people. Then again, that's another consideration. I'm on the phone, you see, and I'm it's a funny thing. The other day, I call up my agency. I got this agent. Now the agent client relationship is a very tenuous one, and one that I think a couple of big magazines like Esquire could very well do a good article on. And in fact, I'm the guy to do it, Esquire. If you're listening, you idiots and clowns. The sad thing about it was that they had a guy recently, and I'm not going to name magazines, but there was a guy who did a story on old radio. By old radio, he means radio about the time of the war and just before. And it was one of the most amateurishly written, badly conceived articles on old radio that I've ever come across. Sad. Get somebody who knows something about it, people. Anyway, I'm sitting there, and I'm talking to my agent. And I call up and I say, anything shaken, Milt? Milt says, nope, how are things with you? I say, okay, Milt, thank you. I hung up. I'm sitting there thinking, and then I began to see that eventually the entire population of the United States and perhaps even the world is going to be divided into two people, clients and agents. And the idea, of course, clients and agents, the idea, everybody has an agent today. I mean, even guys who used to just deal with agents. The agent has kind of wormed his way in between the producer and the performer, whatever it will be. And I have a suspicion now that in the next 10 years, there will be agents for elevator men. They'll be calling their agents. There will be agents for milkmen. Everyone will have an agent. And the agent then will, of course, have to go out and hire an agent. Do you know that I know an agent at MCA who has an agent who handles him at William Morris? And handles all his deals with MCA? I mean, do you understand the implications of this? Do you know what I'm saying? That an agent has gotten to the point where he has an agent who handles his business with the agency he works for. And by the way, I found out for sure now, you know, all these radio stations that are constantly selling time, weather, temperature, and news. I found out that Ashley Steiner has the news account. Ashley Steiner handles all world events. That's their package. That if you do any news, you got to contact Ashley Steiner. If you do the time, it's William Morris. They have the time account wrapped up. Has it ever occurred to you that Alexander King is the Liberals' Norman Vincent Peale? And just about as shallow? And about as didactic? Stand back, I'm an eagle. By George, I'm an eagle. Now, on the other hand, if you're going to be, you've got to do something about your claws, Charlie. They're just not gelling. You've got to do. Did I ever tell you about the time that my Aunt Teresa? You know, every family has an insane aunt. Now, I'm not talking about the aunt that is confined. That's not the kind of aunt that I'm talking about. I'm talking about the angry aunt. The angry aunt who, if she were literate, would write long letters to the post. You know, the kind of long letters that are constantly written to the post, signed disgusted. Well, anyway, my Aunt Teresa, because of her basic anger, my Aunt Teresa used to leave every party with that fire in her eye and screaming at the entire family that never again would she talk to them. Ever, ever, ever again. And I began to understand, of course, as a very small child, that strife, S-T-R-I-F-E, is one of the great vital motivating factors in human existence. It is, well, of course, this has to be told. Aunt Teresa used to go for jello molds. You know, the kind of, she used to mold things out, you know, get the little tin molds. she used to mold things like, salads, jello fruit salads and things. And they always had these little round, fluted-looking arrangements on them. And then she used to mold things in the form of clover leaves. And then she used to mold, she molded everything. I'm telling you, she did. She used to mold her meatloaf. I'll never forget the time I went to her house, and she had a meatloaf that was molded in the form of a lamb. You know the kind of things they use for Easter once in a while to make cakes? One of the worst things that ever happened to me was the time I went to a party about Easter time, and I'm sitting there, I'm a little kid, I'm about 12 or 13 years old. This is when you begin to understand, or you don't really begin to understand, you begin to see things in the world, but you can't put them together. Now, the idea of being able to put together widely divergent, almost completely self-canceling facts that somehow seem to make sense to people is called maturation. Sadly enough, that the older a person gets, the less he can see the idiocies of the lives that many of us live, the complete canceling out. A churchman, for example, getting up talking about brotherly love in a segregated church seems to make sense to a lot of people. Well, this is the whole thing that I'm talking about. We can put these things together and never seem to escape, but a kid can't, you see. He does not know the proper answers. Not that are arrived at by any kind of logic, but, quote, proper answers. And so I'm sitting there, I'm a kid, and it's an Easter thing, you know, and it's a party, and all of them are there. Esther Jane, Dawn, did I ever tell you about Dawn Strickland? I cannot hear the word Dawn today without getting a kind of a shaky feeling deep down inside of my stomach. Oh, she was fantastic. I mean, I knew her, let's say, from the age of 6 up through about 12. And it was the most, I never once even uttered a word to this girl. But I was, it's the wordless, soundless, adoring love. And if Dawn Strickland showed up, she could be 350 pounds, have 9 kids, and wear brass knuckles. I would just fall flat on my face right in front of her with geraniums growing out of my ears. I mean, she's just like that. If somebody called me up and just said, I'm Dawn, my name is Dawn, I would be putty, I would be jello, I would be silly putty in your hands. No use at all, just to make odd little shapes out of me, that's all. Well, anyway, I'm sitting there, and it's this party, see, and the woman comes out, who is the mother of the house, and she puts right down in the middle of the table, right in front of me, a big cake made in the shape of a lamb with white icing on it and covered with coconut to give you the idea it's fur, you know, and it's wool. And it had two little blue marbles for eyes looking right at me and a pink ribbon around its neck. And I'm looking at this lamb. It's a lamb right there in front of me. And Esther Jane gets up with the carving knife and lops its head right off and says, this is for you. Great Scott. Speaking of the shorn lamb, this is
WOR Radio, your station, not for shorn lambs, but for news.
A man with drive.
A man with drive.
Teresa loved to concoct molded foods because this was the only way that she could actually overtly do the molding that was part of her innate desire to deal with other people. In short, her only real satisfaction came from molding other people's lives. Ever tell you what she did to my Uncle Fred? I had this Uncle Fred who was one of these totally harmless people. Now, I'm not going to be the one who stands up and says that the nice people are the totally harmless people. Because quite often the totally harmless people are likewise the dullest people and contribute to probably the worst thing that man has to fight all of his life, and that is boredom. To be surrounded by totally nice people, in many ways, is to be surrounded by total nothingness. And I'm afraid of that. You know, one of the major colleges here in the East is conducting. It's a 3-credit-hour course subject that is in the social humanities division of the university. Creative friendship, 1 and 2. Well, that's neither here nor there. Aunt Teresa did something to Uncle Fred which I will never forget. Uncle Fred was one of those wild dreamers, which, by the way, are almost completely out of our world. You know, one of the most interesting outgrowths of the 20th century man was the man who we call today the backyard inventor. The backyard inventor almost does not exist now. I mean, he can't any longer because inventing has become a corporate procedure. That people invent things in laboratories with a lot of other people involved. A lot of technicians and a lot of technicalities and test tubes going. But the guy who just sits down in the basement and spends 25 years inventing a new kind of Venetian blind that is operated by a push button. And the thing that made the backyard inventor great was the fact that usually, in many, many cases, I shouldn't say always, but in many cases, his dream was totally unrelated to an actual need. In short, if a man sat down and tried to invent something that really was needed, okay. But many of them just sat down there and invented something that had no actual use at all, except in the mind of the inventor. Well, Uncle Fred was an inventor. He really wasn't an inventor because of what Aunt Teresa did to him. It would be as if, well, now I know a lot of guys who would have been writers or who would have been actors or who would have been poets if it wasn't for what Aunt Teresa did to them in one way or another. Well, Aunt Teresa was an angry woman. She was like a rhinoceros. I mean a truly angry woman. She was gray. She was born gray and sort of jowled with two small blue wrinkled angry eyes looking out of that boiling turmoil of a soul. And what she got angry about, no one ever knew, because she had 4 other sisters who were totally the other way. I mean, the kind who played bingo and bunco all the time, all of their lives, you know, always hitting little bells and hollering bunco, that sort of thing. They lived on bridge mix and small talk, idle chatter, constantly in and out of the butcher shop all the time. Not Aunt Teresa. Aunt Teresa, out of that, you know, this is an interesting thing. You know, sociologists are constantly trying to determine which is the most important, heredity or an environment situation. They constantly go back and forth. Sometimes in the long haul of the study of sociology and or psychology, one time the pendulum swings towards environment, then it'll swing towards the business of heredity, back and forth. Well, Aunt Teresa came from the same environment and the same heredity, the same situation entirely. And she was, this is like Mendel's law. I think Mendel's law not only works with red hair, it not only works with corn. You know what is it, Mendelian's law? Isn't it Mendel? I think I'm trying to remember my second year biology. Anyway, he's the guy who said that if somewhere all the way back in the early generations of corn, there was one red plant and there were so many white plants, that 1 out of 4 of the corn that will grow, the recessive and the aggressive characteristics, something like that. It's amazing how your education becomes just like a pot of jello after a while. little isolated facts float around in it. And usually these isolated facts have become non-facts. Little isolated would-be, used-to-be facts. It's like your education becomes, in a sense, like a bowl of Campbell's vegetable soup with all those little A's and B's floating around. And each A and each B can authentically be said to be part of our language and really are taken right out of, let's say, James Joyce. He used a lot of B's and a lot of A's and a lot of C's, but there they float around in there amid all those bits of celery and cucumber and okra, all the rest of the glop that you get glossed over your education as you get older. And so I remember Mendel's Law, you know, and Mendel's Law maintained somehow that if the let's say the recessive characteristic of corn is red corn, and the aggressive characteristic, in other words, the most common characteristic, is yellow corn, and that one out of four plants would be red, and the others would be yellow. Well, I suspect this also works in human temperament. That if there are four nice guys born in a family, one sorehead has got to come along if you wait long enough. I mean, it might go for three generations in those soreheads, and suddenly there will be nine soreheads born that will make up the whole statistic, you see. Well, Aunt Teresa was the sorehead. This actually was the aggressive characteristic of the family. The other three sisters, or the other four, actually, were biological sports. I happen to know the family. We'll not even get into that. And so Aunt Teresa was angry. Boy, she was sore. She was sore the Chicago Tribune, which is an angry newspaper, one of the very few newspapers that in a sense caters completely to the ego of the great unwashed, the paper that just announces on the top of its sheet, the world's greatest newspaper. Wouldn't you like to have that kind of ego? WOR, the world's greatest radio station here. And now stay tuned for Ed and Peggy. You know, it's that complete, I don't imagine it's belief in yourself. It goes beyond that. And so here is Aunt Teresa. She's born and bred on the Chicago Tribune, solidly believing, and incidentally, this is part of the Chicagoan's creed. Chicago is the only city in the world that I know of that has a yearly day that says one thing on great big signs: thank God I'm a Chicagoan. That's a fact. I'm telling you a very true thing. And I'm sitting there one day in Soldier's Field, and they're having hot diggity dog I'm Chicagoan day, and they're marching around, and the American Legion is out there, and the bands are playing, and the Chicago flag is flying below, by the way, below the United States flag, I will have to tell you this, but above several other flags. And so everything is flying out there, and the lights are going off and on. They're having trouble with the switches, and it starts to rain. And it's raining and raining and raining, and the mayor of Chicago gets up to give a speech. And he says, "Ladies and gentlemen, fellow Chicagoans, fellow Americans." You notice the order in which they appear. "Fellow Chicagoans, fellow Americans. This is undoubtedly due to the unfortunate international situation that those East Coast meddlers, those foreign meddlers have gotten us." And he went on and on into a long tirade describing the rain as a plot by New York to wash out I Am a Chicagoan Day. And it made sense. As Galen Drake would say, it makes a lot of sense. And to them, I guess it did. And Aunt Teresa was a born and bred Chicagoan, which means vaguely angry all the time. That you see, I think the reason that so many people are conscious about being Chicagoans in Chicago is that it hasn't quite panned out. You know, it's like getting all set for the race. Everybody has been grooming the car or the horse or the boat. And vaguely things begin to go wrong. The sails don't quite fit. The saddle doesn't fit. The valves begin to be loose in their seats, and the race comes. You run a fairly decent race, but you're not really actually ever really in the running, except in your own imagination. And this is the problem. So Aunt Teresa did this to Uncle Fred. She took it out, as we usually do. I think most people marry other people, one, because they don't like them. I don't think they marry people because they like them. And don't bring love and the like. I know a lot of people who are in love but who hate each other. It's a completely different process, believe me. And I suspect that Aunt Teresa married Uncle Fred because she didn't like Uncle Fred's dreaming. And we do have a desire to destroy that which disturbs our equilibrium in any situation. If somebody comes into an office, if everybody wears nice gray suits and some guy comes in and wears a blue suit and wears tennis shoes, you got to do something to this guy. You just have to. You have to do it. If everybody buys a certain type of car and this guy comes along driving an Isetta or something, you've got to make something of it. You just have to. And so Aunt Teresa, I believe, married Uncle Fred because she didn't like Uncle Fred. Now, she might have loved him. That was another story. But she was forced into marrying him by the very hate that she bore for what he stood for, which was this kind of gentle James Thurber dream. And Uncle Fred spent all of his hours down in the basement working on a scheme for a new type of movie camera. Now, no one in the family ever knew what this movie camera, because he was very secretive about it, as most people are about their important dreams. It was just known in the family that Uncle Fred was working on a new movie camera. And he had this kind of gray, vaguely poetic look about him all the time. And he was the only uncle I knew as a child who really was, in his own way, a poet. And he was kind of sort of gray and very hazy and foggy. He was not the absent-minded professor. He was not the idealist that are constantly being painted in articles in the New Yorker. He was not at all these things. He was just a man that was vaguely displaced, that the kitchen wasn't his place. He didn't fit in the living room where Aunt Teresa held her court. He didn't fit next to the potted palm. And he was always just sort of vaguely enduring it. And Aunt Teresa was aware of this, you know. You didn't endure Aunt Teresa. You put up with Aunt Teresa. And she wanted him to fight back. That's what she wanted. And she never got a fight from Uncle Fred. And so she was pounding him constantly. The only way he could have ever stopped it would have been to stand up to his full 5'9" and swatted her right in the jaw once. Knocked her down the air shaft and said, "I'm going out for a jug of wine and a loaf of bread and that chick I used to know." That would have stopped Aunt Teresa cold. She would have fallen not only madly in love with him all over again, she would have liked him. You see, which would have been another story. Well, anyway, Aunt Teresa was hammering him on the head all the time, just all the time. And she loved to do it, especially when people were around. I don't know what they were like when people weren't there. But I understand from Uncle Fred it wasn't always that way. He used to say, now, Teresa. That's all he ever said, now. And the poor guy, she used to sit there and everybody's playing. My grandfather and all my other uncles would play pinochle. Well, she hated to see Uncle Fred enjoy himself. And he liked, in his quiet way, to play pinochle with my grandfather and the uncles. And he was the quiet pinochle player. He always used to say quietly, "I pass." But he loved it, even if he passed all the time. Never melded more than 40 pinochle. That's about all he ever melded. He's sitting there and he'd say, "I pass," with a kind of a smile on his face. And he used to drink the beer and he'd just sit there and eat a little cheese and play pinochle. And from the living room, they're doing this in the kitchen. From the living room, you'd hear Aunt Teresa. She had one of these shrill voices that angry people invariably develop. Angry people never have quiet voices. Never. And she's saying, "The other day I was talking to Fred. I don't know what's in that man." And she's going on and on and on. And Fred is just saying, "I pass." And once in a while, between hands, he would say, "Now, Teresa." He'd look into the living room and say, "Now, Teresa." And Teresa would just roll on and on and on like the angry waters of the worst river you've ever seen. Speaking of angry, muddy waters, this is WOR, AM and FM, New York. We will be here until 2 o'clock. Well, Aunt Teresa finally got to Uncle Fred. She finally got to him, and I'll tell you what she did. She moved lock, stock, and barrel. You know, this kind of person runs the family. You don't brook any interference. They lived in a little house that had a basement. Now listen to this. For as long as I knew Uncle Fred, until the last days of his life, they lived in a house with a basement, a little place on North St. Louis Avenue in Chicago. And he was happy because he could spend a lot of time down in the basement, quote, working on the new movie camera. And he had a couple of drills and he had a little lathe down there and he'd bang around. And Aunt Teresa never went down there. She never went down to the basement, ever. She was always talking about that mess in the basement. Someday I'm going to have that mess in the basement cleaned up. That's just the way she said it, and I remember it clearly. And then one day the word came out. They were moving. They never had any children. They'd lived there for years. They were moving to an apartment on the sixth floor of a faceless apartment house on Elston Avenue. Without a basement. Well, I don't have to tell you the rest of the story. The rest of the story tells itself. Uncle Fred, from the minute they moved into that apartment, grew so quiet that he was mute. He never said a word. There was no place to go. And he would sit in the living room there, surrounded by the ferns and the potted palms and the calendars and the key that hung on the wall that said Souvenir of St. Petersburg, Florida. He would just sit there, and once in a while they would go out, maybe every third or fourth Sunday, they would go to my grandfather's house and play pinochle. And Uncle Fred would just sit there, and he wouldn't smile anymore. He would merely say, "I pass." But it was a different kind of passing. It was a surrender. "I pass." And all the while, you could hear Aunt Teresa yapping away there in the living room. And she had a note of triumph in her voice, talking about how wonderful it now is to be in an apartment where you didn't have to worry about all that mess all the time of those rooms down in the basement. And Uncle Fred never said a word. And once in a while, she would say, "Don't you find it so much better living in an apartment? Tell him about it, Fred." You know how people always say, "Go ahead, ask Fred. He'll tell you." Don't you ever do that. Don't ever do that. Don't ever really ask Fred. Do you know how long Fred lasted after they moved into the apartment? 7.5 months. Fred passed away quietly in his sleep at the age of 57, which was a good 20 years too soon, because he came from a family that lived to 110, all of them. Fred just passed. When they were making the bids, Fred one night said, "I pass." And he did. By the way, Aunt Teresa was especially angry about the fact that Fred died in his sleep. She somehow wanted to get in the last word. It was just too late. That's the first woman I've ever seen at a funeral who didn't look sad, who didn't look unhappy, but looked frustrated. There was Fred stretched out. She couldn't say a word. And if there is ever a heaven where guys go, I know what Uncle Fred's looks like. A rotten, crummy, smelly basement with all kinds of tires piled up and an old workbench. And old Fred is standing there. Just standing there working away on that movie camera. Whatever that dream was. There are elements of Ahab in each one of us, believe me. Pursuing endlessly a white whale. I don't know what white whale it was that Aunt Teresa ever pursued. Because Aunt Teresa took the insurance money and cleared out. Went to California, and no one's heard from her since. You have to draw the obvious conclusions. Speaking of obvious conclusions, we have with us this afternoon the Village Voice. And before I go any further about the voice, you know, I had a letter from a girl the other day who said, "Shepherd, sometimes it embarrasses me listening to you. It's as though I'm eavesdropping on something I shouldn't hear." That's a great thing to say. I accept this as a real compliment, because every writer who writes, the reason that so many people write is because the things they really want to say, they can't say even to themselves. They can only put on a blank sheet of paper. And I treat this air, this blank space and the silence that I work in, which is exactly parallel to the white paper that a writer works in, as that same private, that private thing that I own. For this 2 minutes, I'm filling it up with the things I can't tell anybody. I could never tell my mother about Uncle Fred and what I felt about it, because she would be involved too, you see. And she would start getting all flustered and say, "Well, I don't know. I mean, Aunt Teresa," and it would go on and on and on. I can't tell her these things. I can't tell you, Jim, because you wouldn't care. I can't tell anybody, you see. I can only tell it to myself, and this is where I tell it, right here. And I don't do a show for people, believe me. It's not the way a writer writes, either. He doesn't write for an audience. And all I can say is that the last time I will ever mention Uncle Fred, because he was one of the great tragic figures of my youth, and the victory and the defeat, and I'm not so sure that Aunt Teresa really had a victory there, Because in the end, he defeated her, you see, as every human being defeats every other human being in the end, by remaining exactly what he is. That when a person disappears, one of the most frustrated of all men, you know, did I ever tell you about the time I interviewed a murderer one time in a cell? Oh, yes, I used to do a lot of things in this business. I've done many, many things. You know, radio used to be a wildly exciting field of creative endeavor. It isn't any longer. It's a sales medium now, unfortunately. And that's a different thing. And I can remember doing this. Everyone used to be competing. Every radio station would compete for new ideas. And I don't mean gimmicks, sales gimmicks. I mean new creative shows. And one of the things that I did, and I'll never forget, a radio station somehow back in the Midwest got permission of the local authorities to interview people in their jail cells, providing they gave us the right, you know, in other words, the guy had to give us an okay that he wouldn't mind talking. We never used their names, and they were very truthful. And it was a fascinating show to really talk to these guys. And I remember one day I'm talking to a murderer, a guy who had killed another man, who had been his enemy for 25 years, and he finally did it. And I sat there, and I'm sitting next to him in the cell. We're sitting on the bunk there, and it wasn't an official type interview. I was just talking to him, preparatory to interviewing him. And I said, you know, I want to ask one thing that I've never heard anybody ask a murderer. He said, what is it? He's a very ordinary guy. He was a kind of a businessman. In fact, he was a businessman who one day did what they call in papers, went berserk, ran amok, went next door and shot the guy between the eyes, went back and sat down behind his cash register, called the cops and said, come and get me. That's exactly what he had done. And so I'm sitting there and I said to him, how do you feel now? He said, what do you mean? I said, do you feel relieved? I mean, are you glad you did it? He didn't deny he did it, you see. It wasn't those cases where a guy holds out and says no. He says, you know, it has made me madder than ever. I said, what? He says, yeah. That miserable lout is gone now. I can't touch him. I said, what do you mean? I had the feeling I was getting close to a truth here. And this is exactly what he told me. He says, and he used unprintable language. He is gone. I says, what do you mean? He says, let me tell you. He says, for over 20 years, every 3 or 4 days, I would meet that guy on the street, and we would look at each other, and I knew one of us was going to kill the other. One day, either he was going to get me, or I was going to get him. And I used to stand there, and for 10 minutes I would let this guy know just exactly what I thought of him. He was a no-good, miserable, and he went on and on and on. And he says, one day, I don't know why I did it, I got up, I went next door, and I shot him. I said, do you feel glad about it? He said, no. I said, well, what do you mean? You're rid of this clown. He says, I don't know, it hasn't made me feel happy. He still hated the guy? He still thought he did not deserve to live, but somehow, you see, the other guy had won a victory because he was gone now. And all this man was left with was his anger. And there is nothing as sad as pointless anger, which, by the way, I think most of our comics today have. Anger as a package. As a matter of fact, you can buy it now in friendly neighborhood drugstores. It has to be taken in prescription doses, though. You, too, can be a comic. Get mad. and just keep it going, no matter what it is. Just be angry. I've often wondered what's going to happen to most of the comics today if the Democrats get in. I notice a few of them are already paving the way by becoming angry about the Democratic candidates so that they will be on record, so when one of them wins, he will be able to say, ha-ha-ha! I'm vastly amused by pointless anger. I hope my show doesn't sound that way. I am not angry. In fact, I am wildly excited about life. And for that reason, I am constantly running afoul of things and at the same time being amused. You don't think I was mad at Aunt Teresa, do you? No. I think she was equally tragic. Not angry at Aunt Teresa. Not a bit of it. Do you think I was angry at the Hopeless Cab Company? No. I liked the Hopeless Cab Company. as a matter of fact, as opposed to the Brighton Cheery Cab Company, which has the dirtiest cabs in New York. And so you see, it all balances out. It's just here, there, and then. And speaking of comics, I would like to point out that Jules Pfeiffer has a new book out that got a wild review in the Village Voice this week. And this is a book called The Explainers. Now, it's a funny thing about one person talking about another. I'm in the position of talking about a man who, in a sense, is in the same general area of social commentary that I am. And I can say that I admire 99% of Jules' work. I think his work is magnificent. I will say that if you're interested in a review of Pfeiffer's new book, I would suggest you pick up a current copy of The Village Voice, and Gilbert Milstein of The Times has written a review. I am not as wildly enthusiastic as Gil is. However, I think Jules' work is extremely valuable, and I would like to point out that his work, almost all of the things in the current book, which I think is better than his last book, by the way, this is a personal opinion, appeared originally in The Village Voice and in The London Observer, and a few appeared in Playboy. It's a compilation of his best work of the last year or so, and it's a real big dollar and a half purchase. And if you're making the Village scene in the next 3 or 4 hours, the place to get this book, I think that they're on sale most everywhere in good bookstores, but I know that there's a big stack of them right now down in the paper book gallery. And if you're making the Village scene during the weekend, I would suggest you drop into the gallery. They're open tonight until, 2 in the morning, you know? It's one of the few places I know of where you can idly spend your time just standing. You know, we have a terrible sense of guilt in our time, where if you're ever just standing, not doing a darn thing, you feel guilty. You can do it with complete immunity in the paper book gallery. Somehow you have a sense that you're absorbing you're absorbing culture, even if you're just standing there scratching. And I would suggest that you do it at the paper book gallery down on Sheridan Square. They're open until 2 in the morning. And if you're listening, walk in and see what happens. I'm not going to tell you any more. Just walk into the... I'm not going to say any more about this than to just drop this hint. If you go into the paper book gallery in the next 3 or 4 days, just walk up to one of those smug clerks and say, "Excelsior, you fathead," and stand back and see what happens. Really, seriously, don't worry about him. I can Indian wrestle any one of the crowd to the ground and all four of them together. So don't worry about him. If I can do it, you can do it in spades. It really doesn't matter. This is the Paper Book Gallery, and they're also over on 3rd Street, back of the NYU campus. And while we're on the subject of Jules Pfeiffer, I would like to point out that all of Pfeiffer's work originally appeared in The Village Voice. I told a little story the other night about meeting Ed Fancher. Did I tell you about that strange little thing? You know, this town, I meet more people I know in New York than I ever met in any small town in the Midwest. There is something inbred about New York. I can ride on a bus up Fifth Avenue and look out, and I'll see 35 guys in every block that I know. Did I tell you the other day I'm riding on the bus, and I see Charles Adams standing by Rockefeller Center, just standing there moodily? He's a great big guy, sort of a, you know, kind of a successful insurance man-looking guy, and he's standing there by Rockefeller Center looking from Fifth Avenue towards the big Rockefeller Center building, you know, where the skaters and all that, and he's just sort of standing there in the sun, and people are walking past him, and says, "By George, there's Adams." And I wanted to bang on the way, "Hey, Charlie, hey!" But the bus kept right on going, and we go a little bit further, and I see, in the next block, I see Ogden Nash walking along. And you know, it's strange. Then I see three guys named Fred that I know. And it just goes on and on and on, this city of New York. Anyway, I'm walking across the street, right in the middle of a fantastic traffic jam. I'm struggling in between cabs and all, and suddenly a door flies open and out falls Ed Fancher. And he hollers, "Hey, Shepard!" And he throws a dollar to the cab driver, and we run into the crowd. We had to run because the bill was a dollar and a half. And Ed publishes The Village Voice, which has no more than a dollar a week expense account for any executive on the staff. And we tore down the street and into the Horn and Hardart, which is always a safe haven. And we're sitting there, and Ed and I are having a cup of coffee, talking it over, when all of a sudden two guys got up from the next table and came over to us, two thin guys who are engineers in some place out on Long Island. And one of them said to me, "Hey, Shepard, you're Shepard, aren't you? And I said, yeah. I like the stuff you do in the Village Voice. I read you in the Village Voice, and I like that story you had there called The Prince and the Rose. I just thought I'd tell you, I like it. I said, Ed, hey, fella here, this is Ed Fancher, who publishes The Voice. He says, glad to meet you, Mr. Fancher, your paper swings. I'm glad to meet you. And this little thin guy with his friend turned around apologetically and then came back and said, would you please autograph my voice? He never once mentioned I was on the radio or anything. I was being acknowledged for something that I kind of sneak in the back way and do. It's a wild thing, you know? And so Ed and I are sitting there, and I said, Ed, you know, this is great. And Ed turns to me, and he says, wow, this is what it's about, man. And then we left and walked down the street feeling magnificent. And if you'd like to know about this paper, it is now the ninth largest, and that is a real record for a paper that started just 4 years ago. It's now the ninth largest weekly in the entire United States. And there are a lot more than nine weeklies in the United States, believe me. I'm talking about weekly newspapers. And Ed told me the other day, and I shouldn't say this on the air, he says, we are going to be the number one weekly in 2 years. And I believe it. This is an important little paper, and if you would like to subscribe to the Village Voice, that really feels that that's what it's all about, having people read it, give them a call now at Watkins 4-4669. Watkins 4-4669. And if you live out of town, it's $3 a year, by the way, and it's a really big $3 worth. You're going to get angry. I had a letter from a minister the other day. He says, Shepherd, that Village Voice really tees me off. He says, but I can't stop reading it. And so there he is every week in his rectory, every Wednesday night, wrestling with the devil. And he just can't stop. That's right. I would like to suggest the number. It's Watkins 4-4669. You'll get in touch today with their empathy editor, who is on the switchboard today, taking the calls. Ask for empathy editor and make contact. It's Watkins 4-4669 here in New York, and they will pay for out-of-town calls. They will accept the charges from no matter where you're calling. They will bill you, and you'll start getting the paper next week. What we are doing, to use the vernacular, is turning you on. I'm sorry. You know, it's like this little news note. I mean, you just can't help it. And I might as well clear up the village while I'm at it right now. Right next to the paperback gallery, if you're going to really make it this week, on 3rd Street, about two doors up, is Ying and Yang. Ying and Yang is at 82 West 3rd Street and is really, I think, one of the finest, most interesting, certainly one of the most pleasant restaurants in New York. This is a considered opinion of mine, and I am very serious. Marty Geisler of the Paperback Gallery called me the other day, and he says, you know, actually, I'll tell you who told me this. It wasn't Marty, come to think of it. It was Louis de Rochemont, who makes movies. De Rochemont was sitting in his office one day, and a friend of his came in. And this is an important movie maker, you know. They're sitting there in very official offices. Guy says, I don't know. I understand you know this guy Shepard. And Louis says, yep. He says, well, you know, I listen to him every week. He says, I don't, you know, he says, commercials I don't pay much attention to. But the other day, and they live way up in Connecticut, he says, the other day, we're going to New York for the weekend, see. And my son insists, he said, I wanted to go to Sardi's or one of these jazzy places. My son insists on going to Ying and Yang, and we were also on Saturday night, instead of going to the movie, we were going to go to Ying and Yang. We were also going to make the Paperback Gallery. He says, this kid is 13. I said, so, all right, you know, it's his birthday, the whole routine. So we came down, and he said it was a wild place, and he said he really dug the food. And more than that, he says, I bought about $28 worth of stuff in the Paperback Gallery, and I get books free. Yeah, it was a wild thing. And he says, I don't know. He says, Shepard must have to be very careful about who he picks to sponsor him because people really do it. Well, that's true. I'm going to point out, I am the despair of the sales department. I do not have to do this for a living. Anytime I want, I can go back to the steel mill. I'm telling you, my card is still good in Local 1010. It is. I still hold a live card in Local 1010 of the United Steelworkers of America. I'm a member in PETA, and I'll never forget Mr. Snyder when I left the steel mill, the tin mill, actually. He says, Shepard, the latch key is always out. So any time I want to come back to the tin mill assorting department, I can. So I don't do this for a living, I'm telling you. I would like to recommend Ying and Yang. And I'm going to pick up a couple of friends of mine, and I think I'll go down there and pamper myself again this weekend because it's Easter. And I'm going to go down in Ying and Yang, and I'm going to eat some of those chicken wing appetizers. I think I'll be there around, I don't know, it's my own business. Whenever I care to pull in, I'll pull in. But seriously, every weekend, I like to treat myself to one magnificent meal, and Ying and Yang is where I go. It's 82 West 3rd Street in the Village. They are open until 1 o'clock this morning, and they are open Sundays until 1. They're open at noon, and they are open every other day of the week. They do have a bar. And one more note, we have the Village Voice, we have Ying and Yang, and most importantly right now, the Electronic Workshop. The workshop is on 26 West 8th Street in the Village, and believe me, if there's anything I'm careful about selecting, as far as a sponsor is concerned, is an electronic concern. I happen to be an amateur radio operator. I don't know whether you know anything about what a ham is, but an amateur radio operator is a man who probably most of his life has had a deep and abiding interest in things electronic and knows something about them. I think one of the great flim-flam games of our time is the retail electronic store. Would you agree with me, Jim, or not? Jim knows, too. He's a ham. This is a fact. And it has bugged me for a long time that most electronic shops, many of them, I should say, use the great ignorance of the public to work against the public. In short, many people feel that electronics is kind of a magical thing, you know. They put it in the same classification with brain surgery, with psychology and astrology. And it's a thing, I don't know anything about it, take it. Just take it and fix it. And they bring it in, and of course, this is a terribly open situation. You get it back, and they have written down a lot of incomprehensible things on the bill of sale, and all you know is that every part costs $23.50, and they have to send to Denmark to get it, according to what the guy tells you. And you wind up with a bill of $67 for work on a preamp, which cost you $58 new. And it's a sense of hopelessness, you know? I would like to point out that the electronic workshop is diametrically opposed to this kind of operation, and they really are. For that reason, they're constantly bailing to keep above water. You will find this true. You will find bailing cans lining the entire wall, the south wall of the electronic workshop, because every 2 weeks when the rent comes due, they got to bail. It's at 26 West A Street, and you will find these people honest, and currently they are having a big sale of almost all the nationally advertised brands of high-fidelity equipment. If you've been looking for things that you specifically are interested in, find out what they're charging today at the workshop, and they themselves will maintain it for you. They will stand behind it. It isn't just one of these little things in the box when you open it up. It says warranty. Have you ever once tried to get your money back on a lifetime pen that fizzled out 6 weeks before you died? I mean, you know, this idiotic term, lifetime guarantee. The lifetime for what? The other day I go into a store where you see this probably amplified more than anything else, more than anywhere else, is on Times Square. You know, I'm driving along going in a cab going west, and I'm coming along there, and suddenly there is an omen before me. It's one of these places where they sell Japanese cameras. You know, the little Japanese. Did you ever know anyone who was taking pictures with one of these tiny Japanese cameras? What a beautiful idea for a cartoon. There is an idea for a cartoon, cartoonist. There are about 28 guys taking pictures, you see, of this model. You know, at the National Photography Ball and that they have. Guys are standing with Leicas, with Nikons, with all kinds of Zeiss lenses, stuff hanging all over them, Rolleiflex, Rolleicords, Iconoflexes, and they're all there. Lights are going. In the middle of it all is a little guy taking a picture with a 69-cent Japanese camera held up in his left eye. I have never seen anybody use one of these things. And you can always tell how the economy of the neighborhood is going by the price they're charging. The saddest one of all is a place on 42nd Street the other day that I saw that had a sign, Japanese cameras, they work, they work, they work. And it said, 39 cents, special closeout sale. It's the cheapest I've ever seen them. Over on 5th Avenue, they're 89. The same cameras. Japanese cameras, they work, they work, they work. And you know, it's a funny business about this Japanese camera world. The whole world, I see this shop ahead of me, and it's filled with Japanese cameras and Italian ashtrays and all the other stuff that you see in these shops. And in neon, it says, price war. Somehow I like the idea of a price war that is a war that is so permanent it now has its bulletins in neon, which are very expensive bulletins. And as I went past in the cab, I could hear the small arms fire. Of course, it was late, you know, and the commanders had battened down the trenches for the night. And you could hear a little patrol action going on once in a while, a little skirmishing out there in the barbed wire. But the price war, it was one of those lulls, one of those momentary, beautiful lulls you get in the war. And I went into this price war joint, and I just had to go in. I stopped and I went in. I wanted to see how the battle was going. And a couple of guys were crouched down there behind the cash registers. And I could hear, you know, it's a funny thing. It's right back in old Company K, I can remember. And I could hear the field phones once in a while buzzing back there in the OP. And I walked in, and the Japanese cameras were piled up. And the word had just gotten out that one of the enemy patrols had just reduced the price to 59 cents on Japanese cameras. And they had dialed and were trying to get the divisional headquarters. And someone had cut the wire somewhere along the line, you know, one of these wire patrols, and there was a little confusion. I walked in, and they had signs there, you know, all over the place. A price war, war has been declared, war. Absolute war, unqualified, absolute conditional, unconditional surrender war. All war type war. Terrible, terrible, the whole thing, you know, they had concentration camp there in the back for captured customers who had been seen in other stores. It was an awful thing. It was an awful situation going on there. The whole business, and they even had a Hitler in the back there. I could hear this Hitler exhorting his troops in the back. He said, I don't care what they are going to do. We are going to draft them out of business. That is what we got to do. And I could hear him back there, and they closed the door because I was a customer. Obviously, they didn't know where I was from, and I complained immediately that I was from a neutral country. I represented one of the neutral powers, and I just wanted to see what was going on and to see whether the articles of war were being properly observed. And there was a sign there that said, forced to sell. And everything in the window had a sign that said, forced to sell. And I walked up to he was a PFC, a BAR man, and I walked up to this guy and I said, hey, who's forcing you to sell this stuff? And he looked around, he said, the landlord. I said, the landlord? He said, yeah, the landlord. I said, but isn't that true of the A&P store down there? They're forced to sell everything they've got too, or they're out of business. He says, yeah, but don't say it too loudly. And I had suddenly discovered the secret of the price war. And it was a funny thing. Just when I left, this guy, he hollers, gas, gas! And of course, being an old GI, I immediately reached for my hip and realized that my gas mask was gone and was filled with a bag of Hershey bars. Caught again. And I skulked out and tore down the alley and I was gone. It's funny, you never really lose the foxhole instinct. You don't. But then on the other hand, don't panic now. You see, there's a weekend coming up, and even though your lock has been changed, don't panic. It's all for the best. I mean, it's all for the best because, well, you know. I mean, you can push and you can push. It's like the other day. I'm looking at the New York Times. It's sad what idiotic ambitions we have. And there's a note that the New Jersey legislature has voted 59-0 to change the name of the New York Port Authority to the New York New Jersey Port Authority. And, you know, it's so sad. We're all trying to make it. And one way, poor New Jersey. So let's think about New Jersey over the weekend. And I will see you tomorrow at 9:05 with the fist fight out. Be the first in your neighborhood to admit total defeat. Harold Teen here.
This is W.